So perhaps, Dr. Chappella, we could just go briefly over the story, starting with the deal between Swiss biotech company Novartis and the department of the university there where you work.
Yes, that particular story goes back to the year 1997, which is 1 year into my arrival here at Berkeley. And the situation then was that the then second largest agrochemical and pharmaceutical company in the world arrived at Berkeley saying we're going to establish a $50 million deal with the university. I was told that as faculty representative, I represented the whole faculty of the College of Natural Resources, and that was it. There was no input from the faculty in general, yet the university was poised to sign as a whole an institutional agreement for $50 million with this company. Of course, there was a big outcry, and I, as a faculty representative, was in charge of leading the opposition, really, a very large number of faculty expressed against this. That led us to major international attention, led us to hearings, legislative hearings in Sacramento, the capital of California, and to a major upset of the university because they really thought, I believe the administrators thought, that they were going to do this under shrouds. So that was the beginning. It took a couple of years, for 3 years, for that to really develop. I claim that it is because of that, or at least partly because of that, that now my position at Berkeley has been finished.
So could you outline some of what the deal between Novartis and the university entailed in terms of proprietary rights, etc.?
Yes. The agreement that as it was proposed was a $50 million agreement. $25 million of that was going to go to what the company really wanted, which was a research agreement. And $25 million were going to come as capital improvement for the university in general. In the end, the $25 million for capital improvement were not signed. So the one thing that some people were holding up as well, you know, we have to just go through this so that our infrastructure can be improved, was not signed. The other $25 million came with what I consider very onerous strings attached. The agreement on property rights is relatively limited because the university will always hold patent to any discovery done at the university. But the company acquired first right of looking and first right of negotiation over any discoveries that would come from this agreement or from any other research that had been that had happened in that department. They had first dibs basically over one-third of the research in the department, regardless of who the funder actually was, including the federal government, including the state government, or charitable institutions. The company also gained 2 out of 5 seats for their employees on a committee that decided where the money was going to go. That means what research was supported or not. And they also gained 2 seats out of 5 for their employees in a campus-wide committee that continues to this day to decide what direction the research policy for the university should take. So those are things that I consider extremely onerous. In the larger picture, my claim is that what the company Novartis was looking for mostly was a measure of validation of their products. They realized at that time that the success of their genetically modified organism products in the market was really dependent on public acceptance. And I believe that they were looking for a university such as Berkeley with its recognized tradition of, you know, questioning and critique. To have a rubber stamp from that university would have been an incredibly good omen for their products in the market. And I really do believe that was a very important element of the negotiations.
So let's talk about the research that you and David Quist carried out, which demonstrated problems with the genetically modified organisms in Mexico.
Yes. That happened some years later as the blooming of the deployment of genetically modified organisms here in the U.S. Continued to evolve. And as I was, you know, I was aware of policy and the politics of it, I realized there is very little control and very little support for anyone who would find problems with this. And one of the most important problems that were on the horizon that many people were worrying about was whether these GMO plants would stay put where we place them. I was working at that time with a coalition of indigenous communities in the state of Oaxaca in southern Mexico. And discussing with them, we realized, well, there won't be anyone to tell you when, if and when this contamination, the movement of transgenic GMO DNA into your corn will happen. So they decided to generate the capacity to do it. The first time that David Quiz, who was a student in my lab at the time, looked with them, they found an alarmingly high level of presence, contamination of the local varieties of corn with transgenic GMO genetic material. And this, of course, is something that by legislation, by international agreements, and by a general agreement of the scientific community, is something that we did not want to see happen. We did not want to see the importation of this GMO genetic material into this part of the world, which is the area where corn was, or maize was first domesticated, and where a very large amount of the diversity that the world relies on for the production of commercial corn is located. So we did not want to see that happen. There were laws in place, there were international agreements in place, and yet hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the nearest legal planting of transgenic maize, we very soon were able to detect its presence up in the mountains of Oaxaca.
And so there were two aspects of that. One was the presence of the genetic contamination, and also there were findings, I believe, that suggested inherent instabilities in the transgenic construct?
You're right. There are two statements in that article. The first one was simply the equivalent of asking, is there anything there? And the unequivocal answer was yes. That's something that has never been challenged, that many researchers continue to find when they look. The second statement that we made was one that we were curious about. We said, okay, once you know that it's there, the question was, where in the genome, in the general overall genetic makeup of the corn plant, where in the genome are these small pieces of DNA located? For that, you have to use, or we used a method that is much less precise, and it's speculative in many ways. You have to speculate because what you find is a sequence. What you find is the equivalent of finding a string of letters, and then the task is to find where that string of letters comes from the greater library, if you want to use that metaphor. And, of course, you will find, if the string of letters is short enough, you will find that string of letters in many different places, or at least close to that string of letters. That's more or less what you do with that second method. And using that method, we found, number one, that there were several different small fragments of the larger construct that was introduced by whoever introduced it there, so that there was some evidence of fragmentation. This wasn't news. Other people had been finding the previous year the same effect on canola and soybeans. But we also started finding the location of this DNA that suggested that, at the very least, there was an incorporation of this DNA into different places within the genome of the corn plant. Now, that can be interpreted, but it's not the only interpretation that we gave. It can be interpreted as suggestive of instability of the GMO DNA piece, the so-called construct, transgenic construct. it can be interpreted as instability of that, but it's not proof of it. Because it's not proof and because it's open to interpretation, that was used as a source of discreditation of the whole paper through what was found later on by The Guardian in Manchester in England to have been a well-coordinated, well-paid PR campaign, mostly through the internet, to discredit the paper and myself and my student by a company, by a large global PR company that at least we know was retained by Monsanto. I don't know if there were other companies behind it, but I haven't been able to find out, and I think the reporter did not go that far.
Can you speculate on what some of the economic implications might have been for your findings for the companies involved?
Well, it's not really speculating that much. By the time when we were doing this work in the year 2000, the biotech industry, especially the agrobiotech industry, had been declared by the financial markets and the people who are in the in as something really not to be invested in. In the year 1999, the summer of 1999, the Deutsche Bank, the largest commercial bank in Europe, published a report for their investors saying, you know, it's time to move our money out from the ag biotech sector. So the whole make it or break it for the whole industry really depended on public credibility and credibility with investors. So the finding of a lack of control, which is the one thing that these companies have always held as source of quieting public discomfort with it. They say, well, we have it under control. We know exactly what we're doing. Finding that that is not really true, that the question of control is really out of control, was, I believe, very, very important for that public image and for the credibility of this whole enterprise, not only specifically one company or the other, but the whole enterprise. In the eyes of the public, and I believe in the eyes of many governments, especially those people in government who know something about biology, it represented a very important challenge, an economic challenge, to an industry that was already banking. De facto ban of the European Union on transgenic crops and importation of transgenic organisms became much stronger because of that finding. I know that in several places, several venues where the ban could have been lifted, our paper was pulled out and presented as a very disturbing evidence that would that supported the ban that the European Union was placing on these organisms.
Can you give us an overview of the tenure renewal process and how it's unfolded?
As you might imagine, I don't know who your listeners are, but the academic review process is an incredibly Byzantine, complicated process that involves many different actors and many different instances of review and so on and so forth. But in the end, it is still a very monastic-like decision that has several stages of secrecy, several points of control that can override the whole process and so on. In the very end, the decision on tenure, which is permanency on the job, is a decision that is the sole privilege of one person only, and that is the chancellor, in our case, the chancellor of the university. So there is a whole process that leads to the chancellor's desk, and then the chancellor will decide whether to give tenure or not. The decision in my case was to deny tenure. That happened in November of last year. But the strange thing, and the thing that really has many people very upset, including myself, is that that decision was reached right at the top in the face of undeniably overwhelming evidence. There were probably two or three times as many reviewers from international experts around the world who had the opportunity to look at the case and had the opportunity of to pass judgment. These are all anonymous, so it's impossible for me to find out most of them. I know a few of them through different routes. There were two committees convened on campus of experts also from our campus who had an opportunity in secret, so they could say anything they wanted, to review the case and pass judgment. There was a vote of my department. The chairman of the department, the dean of the department, they all get a chance to say what they think. All that is by far overwhelmingly positive. To give you numbers, 69 experts have passed judgment saying yes. Two experts have, in that whole process, have some hesitation enough for them to say, well, maybe not. But this happened after a three-year fishing expedition, basically, until they could find somebody who would say no. And in the face of these 59 experts, my department voted 32-1 to support the tenure case. Experts internationally, again, voted 17-1. Both secret committees voted unanimously yes. And in the face of all this very, very clear positive evidence, the chancellor simply decided to say no.
So tomorrow is your last class at UC Berkeley. Where to from here for you?
Well, my last class is still, there are still many days in the month of December, and I'm not sure what's going to happen. My position right now is that this is a place that is very important for what I do, which is science, but also science public science and public education. And so my position is that I'm not going anywhere until I get pushed. My position is that I'm being pushed out of the job by illegitimate people through illegitimate means. So I don't see why I should jump off my chair before I get pushed. I see overwhelming support of the people who know about my work, who work with me in the everyday, who have looked at my scholarship. So, and this is the job I want. So I'm here until I'm not. Come January, I will be worrying a lot because I'm going to be unemployed and I live month by month. You know, my paycheck is gets used up at the end of the month. But I'm not thinking about it, quite honestly. I do get a little waves of panic from time to time, but my position is I'm here until I'm not here. So I'm not going anywhere anytime soon.
Given the kind of compromised academic environment we've been talking about, what advice would you have for someone who might be planning to study biology or pursuing a career in the life sciences if they wanted to preserve their integrity?
Well, there are very important lessons, I think, to be had. Number one is if I say this to incoming students into my lab, I say if you're here for the money, just don't do it because it's too risky. This is not a place for, you know, the faint of heart. The other important thing that I've learned through this process is it's very important to understand who it is that you're really working for. If you decide that you're working for a crew of administrators, you will end up compromising, and you will end up compromising too much, no doubt about that. But if you understand that you're working for the public, and if you develop the legitimation of your work through public science, then it is really astounding how much we are needed, how much public scientists are really desperately needed. And I think a show of that is the fact that you're calling me today, the fact that it sounds like tomorrow is going to be a big celebration of the teaching and the research that can be done in the public arena, statement of what the public university stands for. So that is something that I think can be held up in the eyes of young people who might want to do public science as something to aspire and look forward to that is so much more valuable than either money or, you know, the security in a job where you are muzzled. So it's a sweet and sour type of experience. Very powerful one, and a very good one for someone who really, really wants to do public science.
Do you think it's possible that we can wrest back control of these institutions?
That we can regain it?
Yes.
I think it is possible. I don't think it will happen very soon. I think I am doing on the side. I just launched an initiative that's called the Pulse of Science Fund, where we're getting a lot of money going into that. On the basis of the following, it seems as though the institution is really taken over by basically bureaucratic bean counting, just managerial priorities that are very open to financial distortions, to the influence of money, basically. So we need to have places where really critical public questioning can be validated. This question of validation, you know, developing even the social networks that will support the scientists, the people who will ask the questions, and the research. I think that is necessary at the moment to maintain the seeds of what I think has to be reclaimed by a much larger sector of the public, which is the larger university. I think there has to be a sense of crisis that people have to realize that the safety net that the public academia represented for the public is gone, or it's really torn. So it will be at that point, I think, that people who have been investing for generations into these institutions will say, wait a minute, you know, where is the research that we want? So I think it will take a while. I think it's not going to be tomorrow. I don't think there's a simple answer that says, let's just, get rid of the Chancellor of Berkeley and things will change. I don't think it's going to be like that. But I think that there is no other alternative, that people will have to realize what's happened, and they will come back to it because it's needed. To the extent that that we need questioning that is not affected by economic interests, I think people will definitely come back to it. And that's what I'm seeing with this Pulse of Science Fund initiative, that there are many people who are saying, we really want to support a place where people can start figuring out how to get it back.
So you spoke before about the facility that had been set up in Mexico, where the research took place. Can you tell us a little bit about the feeling there when the contamination of corn was discovered?
Yes, I can tell you some things, despite the fact that I have been out of Mexico for a long time, so I should not be taken as representing Mexico or Mexicans, really. But what I gather from my close contacts and my many years of relationship with those people is that the discovery of the contamination has been a major source of almost collective depression. It's very difficult to explain, I think, to an Australian audience how tightly connected the identity of Mexican people, and as well as other people in Mesoamerica, is to this one plant, you know, to corn. So in a very, very real way, the news that we brought, or they found out, of the contamination of that part of their own selves, because it really is like that, has been a source of a lot of just depression and hopelessness and helplessness. For about 2 years, it's been a very difficult process. Now, the mood seems to be changing. People are monitoring. They're demanding the government to at least monitor and tell them what's happening. They are demanding the Environmental Office of the North America Free Trade Agreement, the NAFTA, to look into the problem and say what's happening and what happened and what can be done. But the mood seems to be changing. It has taken a long time, and it seems to be changing to a mood of, I think, a mix of anger and desire, again, to take back whatever institution, whatever instances of governance were involved in just letting this happen without even checking for it. People are saying, we know it's time for us to bring you to account and see how you've been representing our interests. So it's a very interesting, again, sweet and sour, a difficult moment, very full of energy, But a very interesting one where I think finally people are forced to face the reality of what has been happening here.
Thank you very much for speaking to us today, Dr. Chappella.
I thank you.
Good luck with the rest of the campaign and enjoy the rest of the academic year.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye.